Hello and welcome once again to Inside Jobs with me, Robert Barclay, in collaboration with the In-House Agency Forum, or IHAF, and Express KCS, production partner to the in-house community. This episode, we have one of the leading practitioners of in-house agencies and father of one of the most recognised and long-running campaigns in the UK, Australia, and even across Scandinavia. It's hard to overestimate the cultural reach of Graham's tagline, "Should have gone to Specsavers." But the body of work that Graham Daldry produced in his tenure at Specsavers has been a real testament to the power of brands running their own in-house agencies. He left Specsavers in 2020 to write and consult, so I'm thrilled that we have been able to find time in his book writing schedule to join us on Inside Jobs. Graham, welcome to Inside Jobs.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to join you.
Well, it's a real, as I say, thrill to have you with us. The work that you do is extremely well known, but we would like to talk about how you produced such a creative powerhouse for a brand later on. But at the moment, I don't think you have a life of leisure. You do seem pretty busy. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been very busy, actually. I've been writing a book about advertising and about writing, which I'm very much looking forward to getting out, which is nearly complete, actually. I'm just on the last chapter at present, so I'm hoping that that's going to see the light of day quite soon.
So writing a book about writing, what sort of writing?
It's about writing. It's about how to write a line, which is a skill that extends quite considerably outside advertising. But inevitably, having spent nearly 30 years of my career working in advertising, quite a lot of it is also about advertising. But I think that most writers in most disciplines will find it moderately useful. I hope so anyway.
So the aim is to what then? Improve one's ability to convey or to persuade with writing?
It's not really about the art of persuasion as such. It's more about thinking about how you write and the techniques that you use in order to communicate and what techniques work and why. And if you like, you know, if you're a young writer starting off in any writing role, it's designed to give you some tricks and some techniques to overcome some of the challenges that you face, which I remember pretty well, to be honest with you.
Well, so the manuscript's nearly done and it'll be published hopefully later this year. But Graham, let's go back to the Graham Daldry origin then. Where are you actually from originally, and what did you want to do when you were much younger, and indeed was that advertising?
Well, I grew up in Manningtree in Essex, which is a small town between Colchester and Ipswich, and I still live near there. And I really wanted to be a university lecturer for the first 30 years of my life, nearly 30. And I was thwarted in that effort by Margaret Thatcher, unfortunately, who decided that she didn't really like art subjects very much.
So you knew what you wanted to lecture on. It wasn't being a lecturer that you wanted. There was a specific topic in mind.
Yes, I wanted to lecture English, and I spent most of my youth reading, I'm afraid. I was a bit of a geek.
Who did you read there? What sort of books did you enjoy
reading? Oh, everything. Arthur Ransom, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, and then Dickens, Jane Austen. You know, everybody, really. I read everything that I could.
So you were thwarted in your attempts by a personal intervention by Mrs. Thatcher, who felt that a life in commerce was better for the country? Or?
Well, it felt personal, but I don't think it probably was. It was just a belief that she had that sciences were more valuable than arts, and she therefore more or less terminated any prospect of young people having a career as a university lecturer in an arts subject. So faced with that, I did plug on for a few years. I had two or three jobs. Ended up at University College of Wales in Aberystwyth, which was very pleasant but hard to get to. And after that, I decided really to kind of, that discretion was the best part of valour, and decided to, I should probably think, if I really wanted to ever be anything more than penniless, that I should start to think about what else I might be able to do.
So at this point, you were still in your 20s at this point?
Yeah. I was in my mid-20s. So the list was fairly short, really. And I started doing the rounds of various businesses and ended up in a small agency, which a creative director called Ian Dunn had ended up in for some strange reason, I don't really quite know, in Manchester. And Ian Dunn was a great writer, had won Pencils for radio work in London. And
Pencils being creative
D&AD awards. Yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. yes, the most revered form of advertising award, I think, even now. And he was quite an exceptional person to run into in Manchester in those days, because it was full of retired salesmen trying to run advertising agencies. So a lot of the small agencies were quite poor. But yeah, so he hired me as a writer.
And out of interest, do your parents been in advertising or in a commercial? Were they academic or what?
No, both my parents. My father was a poultry advisor for Paul's Animals Foods. And my mother was eventually a primary school teacher, although she only did that quite late in life.
Mm-hmm. But there were no restrictions on your horizons, obviously, as you were developing.
No. They were just happy if I was self-sufficient. Sorry, was there a beep in the middle of that?
So let's go back to Manchester. So you were wandering the streets of Manchester, and did you find this chap, what was his name, Dunn?
Ian Dunn, yeah.
Ian Dunn, did you find Ian Dunn sort of roaming the streets, or did you know him already?
No, I didn't. No, I was really just cold calling different places, you know, knocking on the door. And going,
so you were thinking, who needs someone who can write?
I didn't really even know what I wanted. I sort of almost went and asked them.
So you were you trying sort of every kind of business there was, just looking for a job then?
Well, you know, businesses that seemed remotely creative. I remember I went to chat to a couple of architects and...
Wow. How different things could have turned out. How serendipitous is that? That's amazing.
Yeah, so a few sales jobs and, you know, all that sort of thing. And I wasn't really interested in that because I was, you know, direct selling isn't really. I remember I actually went and talked to some car dealers at one stage, which was quite interesting. Yeah, it was quite an interesting time. And I found out quite a lot about how businesses work, because obviously having been camped in a university for most of my life, I've led quite a sheltered life, really.
Did you find it exciting or daunting?
Yeah, a bit of each.
You're 20. You're in your 20s.
I was pretty angry at Mrs. Thatcher, I have to say.
So were you
still
turning up at every red wedge gig going and throwing things?
I think I might have sold the odd copy of Socialist Worker back in those days.
Interesting. Okay, so that's going to be interesting to compare with your commercial life of capitalism later on. But anyway, so what was your first gig that Ian gave you? Do you remember the first work you were put onto?
Oh, goodness. Now, that's a good question. I think Moben Kitchens is still around, actually.
I think no doubt due to your early impetus given to them, I'm sure, yes.
I think that was something I worked on, and they had some business for various car dealerships.
And how did you feel once you got in the four walls of a real agency? I mean, it was obviously a whole new experience for you coming from academe, but did it thrill you?
Well, I think it felt quite at home to start with, because there were typewriters and it was all quite shabby. So, you know, the agencies, you know, even posh agencies, you know, I used to, you know, go down, take my book around London in those days, and you'd walk into Saatchi & Saatchi into their huge reception. But of course, when you got shown into the creative department, a lot of them were working in cupboards under stairs. I remember I went to see a writer called Dean Turney, who'd done some lovely work for the... I can't remember, National Coal Board, I think, or for real coal fires, anyway.
So you wouldn't get. I remember the campaign, days. Yeah.
Yeah, he'd done lovely work, and he was a good writer. He was working on his own, literally in a cupboard under the stairs.
Wow, that's so. What does that tell you about their place in the agency's kind of hierarchy?
Yeah,
then?
No, they didn't care. No.
So you got your foot on the first rung of the ladder working with Ian in Manchester, it all looked a bit comfortably shabby.
Yeah.
How did you get better upholstery then over the years? Take us on the journey.
Well, like all creatives, I moved around a lot after that. I worked at probably just about almost every agency in Manchester, I think. Ended up at TBWA Manchester.
Is that because they couldn't keep this burgeoning talent, or you just found you just irritating?
I think the motive might have been more financial, I'm afraid.
Really? So you were doing the classic kind of when you're in your 20s and 30s, every couple of years, move on and get a big pay rise along the way.
Well, I wouldn't say it was ever a big one, but certainly, you know, it was pretty necessary at the time. And then my kids were born.
I was going to say, you were having a family around that time as well, yeah?
Yeah, my daughter was born during a pitch upon which my job depended. according to the creative director who hired us at the time.
Did you know that at the time?
Yep.
While you were pitching?
So I kind of alternated between home and sleeping under the desk, really, at one stage.
Did it change your approach to the pitch, knowing that your job depended on it, regardless of what was going on at home?
To be honest with you, I think we were pretty desperate to win everything in those days. So
everyone's job depended on it.
Yeah, I think your job always depended on your last job, didn't it? So.
Yeah. But both came right, I trust? The birth and the pitch?
Yeah, we won that pitch and the one after. And then I went to the agency we'd won the business off and won it back again. So that was quite good. I was quite popular after that.
And what was your responsibility in these pitches that when you were obviously finding your feet at this point? What was your role in among the team?
I was copywriter in a creative team, so I was I worked with an art director, and under the direction of the creative director, what were always quite small creative departments of 5 or 6 teams.
And did you find that having been an English lecturer and having understood English from the point of view of great literature, you could apply that to writing pithy one-liners for a regional Porsche agency?
Well, that's really what my book's about, I think you can either write or you can't, really. And I think that being able to write is obviously a huge advantage,
say you can either write or you can't, do you mean it's an innate ability or you mean it's a learned ability?
No, I absolutely think it can be learned, but I think that if you become a good writer, it's a skill that is transposable. I don't think it's necessarily just applicable to one discipline. So, I absolutely think you can learn to be a writer. But I think I'm fairly sure that having read a lot stood me in quite good stead. And I think that, the skills involved in writing a good line are very similar to the skills that a poet might use, And that sounds very pretentious, but you have to have a feel for language. You have to have a feel for rhythm and tone. You have to be able to speak in a voice, which is the voice of the brand that you're talking for. You have to have a lot of skills that are, very, very universal, really, to be honest with you, across all kinds of writing.
So let's keep going. You were a copywriter in a team, and you were working on some regional campaigns, mostly from the north of England. Where did you go from there?
Well, I ended up at an agency called Poulters, which no longer exists, but Poulters was probably, they sort of specialised in TV, in sort of cheap TV, if you like. And I think that in the time I was there, when I left, I believe I deleted about 2,000 TV scripts from my computer. And that was great training, actually, because it wasn't just the writing of the scripts that was done on a shoestring. The production was also pretty compromised by money or lack of it. So you got involved in everything. And I remember standing in the middle of a Yorkshire moor in the fog, trying to rescue a commercial for Yorkshire Water on my own with no help from anyone, and being on the phone trying to find an alternative location that wasn't foggy within distance that the crew could travel. Yeah, and that was me. And I was pretty young at the time. I hadn't really done anything like that before. So that was fun. And we got involved in all sorts of things.
But it sounds like a lot of TV going on there. Were you working in other media as well, or were these sort of, these were all media campaigns, I guess, right?
Well, I think in the course of
print and TV,
of very rapidly learning copywriting in regional agencies, you have to do everything, literally. But Poulters was definitely where I learned to write TV scripts. They had some they had McCain oven chips, they had Fox's biscuits. Sharp TV, Morrison's as well, which was one of the accounts that we won on the pitch. And they all did TV in those days because TV was pretty cheap. By then I was probably, I think myself and my partner were the most senior team in the agency at the time. We got all the TV work, really. And we produced a crazy amount of, not a lot of it saw the light of day, I have to say. But we certainly produced a crazy number of scripts.
So what was the most rewarding part of all of that then? Was it actually being at home with your wife and seeing one of your ads appear? Is that where it all kind of, you congratulate yourself and get that warm feeling?
I think at the time it was just a very, the most rewarding thing has always been really being able to, the great thing about advertising is it all happens quickly. So from beginning to end, you see the whole thing through, you know, so you see an outcome. And I think that, you know, that's something that I think is very rewarding. I think if you're working in a more creative environment, you know, I think more care gets taken and more time gets taken. You know, advertising is always a rush and you always have to get it done. And there's always a compromise between how good can it be and can it actually be done on time? And can it be done for the money? You know, those three things are always fighting each other. And I think, you know, getting the balance right and finding a way of getting something great with all the kind of compromises you have to make is always a battle. But I find it, you know, it's thrilling. And after 3 months, it's usually done and you're onto something else, you know. So it's always fast moving. And that, by the way, really goes even for, well, that actually goes especially for Specsavers, actually, because, you know, although it's just one brand, you're constantly, you know, onto the next thing. It's very fast moving.
So in 1996, you went to the Ogilvy & Mather, yeah?
I did, yes.
Okay, and this was in London?
Yes, it was, yes. So
felt like a step up, I presume. Felt like you were kind of entering the mainstream sort of agency world at this point, did it?
Well, it certainly did in terms of the agency, yeah. At the time, and I think this has changed, but at the time there was a totally different atmosphere in London agencies to regional agencies, you know, the briefs.
Was it champagne and cocaine rather than...
I missed out on all that. But I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. No, the party days were over, but there were certainly, you know, some very bright people, really interesting, you know, really interesting thinkers. And, you know, it was more demanding and challenging in a very good way.
Right. Stretched you. It stretched you more.
And
was this where you started to think more, less about, I've got this tactical issue right in front of me and I need to solve it for the price and I'm in a foggy field in Yorkshire and how am I going to get this done? And more into thinking about how do I get these people around me to produce better work and how do I ensure that we organise this in such a way that it's most effective? Is it at your time at O&M where those sort of thoughts started to come along?
Yeah, well, I've been responsible for other advertising teams while I was working up north. Mm. And, you know, managing other creatives is something that kind of comes... I think you know, it's almost like teaching, isn't it, really? You have to teach people, really, rather than... It's not like normal management, which is something I've explained to countless HR departments in the course of my career. Mm, mm. But, you know, it's not the same. You know, you're actually trying to teach people how to do things. And, you know, and that's the secret of success, really. And I think if you mentor people well, and encourage and coach them well, you can really get an awful lot out of people that aren't experienced at all, because at the end of the day, it's about how well they think, you know, and how well they write.
But it's also a balance of your own bandwidth, your own time that you can apply to mentoring someone and the time they might take in order to get them where you want them to go, right? You have to invest time in them, in other words. And
yes, you do.
There's always a balance, how much time can you invest?
No, you have to learn to value their work as highly as you value your own, which I think a lot of creative directors fail to do, to be honest with you. But you do have to do that in order to mentor people successfully.
How do you overcome, when, especially when you're coming up from the creative side? I mean, there are many types of in-house agency leader, but you know, the majority either come from creative or they come from agency kind of account management side. When you are creative yourself, how do you learn to appreciate what others have created and take that on? Because it says so personal.
Well, I don't know. I think it's something I've always kind of never really found that hard. I don't really know why people find it difficult, to be honest with you. I mean, I think it's
self-confidence and insecurity, surely, isn't it?
Well, I think there must be a lot of that. But I think that if you are really focused on creative, then, you know, you love all creative, don't you? And I think that is really kind of the key to being a good creative director. You know, you have to have a passion for being creative. And I think that passion has to be greater than anything else, you know. So if somebody else comes up with a wonderful idea, you don't feel envious. You just feel, wow, great, let's go with that.
Well, you'd spent a good time working for regional agencies. You'd spent, not that long, actually, was it, really? It was
pretty brief, yeah.
Pretty brief, really. And then in O&M, you were there for 3 years as well. So you really kind of had about 6 years of agency experience, but you'd obviously shot up the ranks as you'd gone. How much did you enjoy your time at O&M, and how did the transition to an in-house agency, which you're going to tell us in a minute whether it really existed in that capacity or not, how did that all come about? I'm curious. Yeah, it all happened very quickly.
I loved it. You know, I loved working at O&M. I loved the people there. I thought that, you know, I really enjoyed it. But the motivation really for moving on was as usual financial, because I was struggling with the consequences of moving down south and, you know, all that stuff. So I was looking for something, you know, that was kind of going to take me somewhere else. And the job at Specsavers was a strange one, really, because I said no to it initially.
So they approached you?
Yes.
How did they know you?
Headhunted. Oh, the headhunter. Uh-huh. They used the same. They used a headhunter that I knew well, who you know, fortunately liked me, and she tried to convince me twice before I actually went, oh, okay, I'll go and talk to them.
And why were you so reluctant? Snobby?
Well, I thought,
were you too,
you know,
snobby about
in
house agencies,
the,
or
yeah, I mean, they're based in Guernsey, so it takes you out of London. Yeah, it takes you out of the main street.
So it wasn't the idea of an in-house agency that put you off so much, it was just their location.
Yeah, that and the, you know, and to be frank, they, you know, the work that they had been producing wasn't amazing, but they did have a strong ambition to improve.
So they were already running their own creative operation. They already had the idea they didn't want to use an external agency, had they?
They'd never used an external agency in their whole existence since 1985.
They're family owned, is that right?
Yes, they are. Yeah, they're independent.
So the family kind of decided. So just again, for people who don't know, so Specsavers is an extremely well-known chain of opticians in the UK, Australia, Scandinavia. And family-owned, family-started in the 80s, yeah?
Yes, that's right, in the mid-80s, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they'd always...
Ironically, as a result of changes to the rules made by the same Mrs. Thatcher.
So you benefited in the end, you see? So,
yeah, I guess I did, yeah.
Win some, lose some. So just tell us a little bit then about the culture at Specsavers that led them to thinking that way before you joined.
Well, really, you know, the beginning of the 2000s, it was in a good position. It was sort of level pegging with the other big opticians. So, you know, Boots and Domination and Vision Express were the main rivals. And it had fought hard to get there, but it had a very good proposition, which is that it basically gave people the same quality for a much lower price. And yeah. I mean, it's a significantly undercut the competition at the time. And obviously, you know, in that market, which is very rooted on medical expertise, that's can be a mixed blessing, and it had been for a while. And I think that probably what it was lacking was a kind of a marketing interface that reflected its positioning in a kind of a human way, you know. So really, right from the beginning, it felt right for me to use humour and a more engaging way of talking to its customers.
So they clearly did tempt you. You said you turned them down twice, but then you went down and they made some offer you couldn't refuse, presumably.
No, when I went to speak to them, Robert, I just thought, what a wonderful band. What an amazing opportunity.
Oh, right. So here's a great bag of toys to play with.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, it just seemed like an incredible opportunity to be able to, first of all, to be able to get my hands on, you know, some lovely briefs, really, and improve the output. And, you know, there was a lot of scope for that. And also to work directly with the marketing director, which I think, you know, is something that a lot of creatives secretly wish they could do more of.
You were able to strip away that interface then that got in the way of the need for the message and the creation of the message.
Yeah, all that horrendous.
And that was conscious on your part, because, you know, you'd think that you'd go there from these traditional agencies and just apply the same model that you'd experienced. But it sounds like you consciously decided that you didn't want that.
No. Being able to walk into the marketing director's office if he didn't like a decision he'd made and ask him why I'd done it, it's just one of the most, you know, brilliant and life-changing.
Can be career-changing too.
Yeah, and it was, you know, and I think, you know, sometimes, you know, you'd have an argument or a discussion or a conversation, depending on how you felt.
Yeah.
and you know, you'd walk out not always having won your point. In fact, rarely having won your point, to be absolutely frank, but at least knowing why we were doing what we were doing, which I think is, you know, something that every creative needs to know.
And that helps you the next time, right?
Totally, yes, absolutely. You learn about how the client thinks, you learn about where they want the brand to go, and it means that you can then find workarounds to remain creative and to come up with a creative solution to the particular problem that, you know, the business faces. And I think that, you know, having that insight is key to why we were able to produce good work. Yeah. And I think, you know, when it's mediated, it is never quite the same. And you're never quite working for the same company, you know. It was really interesting, actually, because about 6 months ago, I was invited to join a webinar, and it was about how the future of retail, I think, was the title of the webinar.
Yeah.
And the other people in the conversation were talking about their customers. But, of course, they were talking about their clients. And it took me...
They were agencies.
Yeah, they were all from agencies, and they were talking about their customers. And it took me about three quarters of an hour to work out why I didn't understand the conversation. Yeah, because I honestly, you know, you don't... That's the difference. That for me, that sums up the difference, the critical difference of being a creative working in-house, because your customers are the customers. And you get, you know, you get a more direct link, you know, I worked in partnership with the marketing directors at Specsavers, but you get direct access to the customers and how the customers think. And when you talk about customers, you're talking about the customers. You're not talking about what the client wants or what the client thinks or what the client expects, because you've kind of taken that into account because you've had those conversations. You know, you don't need to think about that. And I think that's why you are in a much better position to produce good work in-house. And I say in a better position because I don't think it always happens, but that is the potential for me of working in-house.
Well, it doesn't always happen, and indeed in-house agency detractors will gleefully point to where it doesn't work in-house. The most famous one I can think of at the top of my head is the Pepsi campaign from, it must be 2 years ago now, where I think they tried to sort of jump onto the bandwagon of public demonstrations about various causes and landed in a very tone deaf manner.
They did.
Was that not a shortcoming of an in-house agency that wasn't really aware of what was going on in the wider market?
Well, you know, I think it's one thing to have the opportunity, it's another thing to produce good work.
Very good. So let's talk about good work. Let's talk about the band's greatest hit, because I know that certainly a lot of listeners, certainly here in the UK, will be very intrigued about the evolution of the legendary and still running campaign, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, it won't die, will it? I think
it will. It's just still playing the same hit
because even when they, you know, I think it's fair to say that they have tried to quietly drop it a few times, you know, and most recently probably in the last 12 months. But then Dominic Cummings comes along as your introduction, and it's just on everybody's lips, isn't it?
Absolutely. So how does such a thing come about? Tell us about the environment that you'd created there.
And I think the big issue that I had when I arrived at Specsavers was that there wasn't really a creative team to manage. I had I think 6 Mac operators and a kind of a corporate video production team.
So who was coming up with the copy and the creative ideas and the strategy and all that?
Well, there wasn't a lot of it. The previous creative director, the guy that I replaced, had done some of it. You know, there was a bit of copywriting by the marketing people, and you know, all that sort of thing that goes on.
Okay.
It was very small scale, I have to say. You know, it was quite a small account when we started.
And did they give you carte blanche with a budget to go out and recruit? And how difficult was that to do down in the Channel Islands?
Yeah, not at all. No, I had to kind of really fight for it to start with. And I think that, you know, there were a couple of the Mac operators that were clearly more than just Mac operators, a couple of three very talented people. And the corporate video writer was also an extremely good writer, so I commandeered him to come and work for me, and he's actually still there now, Richard James, very, very good writer. And I think that little core of people, that was really where the creative team started, and we then had to sort of prove that was the way to go before we were given any more resources to recruit.
Yeah.
So it was a very small team. It was a very small operation to start with.
But you'd use externals, presumably, for managing shoots and that kind of thing.
Production, yes. Yes. We you'll laugh at this, because when I started there, we used Anglia Television.
Look, that's not very close to the Channel Islands. And were you thinking from the beginning, I need a big idea for this, and getting close to the owners, the brand, the company's kind of forte? And how did you manage to embed yourself in that so quickly?
To be fair, really, that came out of my relationship with Andrew Mole, who was the marketing director at the time, and we worked pretty well together. Andrew was a bit old school in terms of his approach to marketing, but he understood very well that really what we needed was some kind of line, quite often very disparate elements of the brand together. But also, he was very aware of the fact that we were spending, an increasing amount of advertising, but not really increasing our recall. So this was a problem that he confronted me with probably on a weekly basis at one stage. And we were both aware that, we needed a line. And interestingly, we wrote some Should've ads before we had Should've as a line.
Did you?
So we had a line which was simply need an eye test, which, if you think about it, does the same job.
Yeah.
And we wrote some very Should've scenarios. In fact, I don't know if you've seen the ad where the girl runs up to the wrong guy and kisses him. But that ad was actually made before we had invented Should've.
Right.
So
the running gag in all of these, of course, you might want to quickly explain for those who don't know.
Yes, the running gag is just people with very poor eyesight making errors. And, eyesight gags are probably, there are an infinite number of eyesight gags, obviously.
Yes.
And we've used a lot of them, I have to say. So that was where it started. And I think, I think I was aware by then that if we could come up with a great line that really made eyesight gags belong to Specsavers, we'd have something very powerful.
So you knew you wanted humour as well?
Yeah. Yeah, as I say, I think humour was necessary for the brand at the time because it was opticians was such a clinical area, and Specsavers was a disruptive force in the marketplace. And humour was perfect, really, to kind of, first of all, to get people to like us and trust us, and secondly, really, to establish Specsavers as something different in the market as well.
It is fascinating to see how the bits come together, the fact that you had a sort of challenger brand and you therefore knew you needed humour, you needed a line, you needed for recall, and how it sort of came together. And so it wasn't really a sort of Damascene sort of revelation, a moment where it was sort of, I got it, was it? Or was it?
It was a bit, because actually the way it came about, we were producing a series of scripts, some of which ran on radio, but one of them, I think two of them actually ran on TV. Yeah. With a sort of Specsavers family, it was a bit sort of OXO family updated, really. One of the lines in the last one of those scripts wrote, the teenage daughter said to Dad, "Oh, Dad, you should have gone to Specsavers." And that line really leapt off the page then. And, Richard and I think Richard probably spotted it first, actually.
Yeah.
But then, of course, everybody went, "Oh, that's the line."
Yeah.
So that was how it really came about.
That came about relatively early on. You were there for 20 years from around 2000 weren't you?
Crazily, yes.
Mm. So a question people often ask about in-house agencies is how do you keep it fresh when, especially when you've got a tagline that just won't die, as you put it?
When we started, Specsavers were very challenged in terms of their frame choice. And obviously there's a fashion element. So, and at the time, technology was making small frames possible, which actually they hadn't been possible in the past. The wire frame technology was just coming in.
Yeah.
And it was very important to tell people that we had small wire frames rather than the sort of big plastic glasses that people had been used to. So quite a lot of the early work was you really should have gone to Specsavers for a nicer looking pair of glasses. And that became impossible to say after a few years, because of course fashion becomes eclectic, as it always does.
Mm-hmm.
But initially it was about that. So we had fun with that. But then once that stopped working as a proposition, it was only really then that, and I think with the Mole left in 2007 and Richard Holmes joined us from Boots, and it was really with Richard's arrival that we started doing what I think of as the kind of the classic Should've's. So one of the first ads we made for Richard was the collie where the shepherd shaves his dog
instead of his sheep.
That ad was made in 2008 and it was running at the beginning of last year. One of our best ads was a hearing ad. I don't know if you call it. It featured a guy at an isolated Arctic observation station. He'd run out of food, and he gets his airdrop, and a clown pops out of the crate, much to his disgust, and he gets on the radio and he says, I said supplies. He's been sent a supplies.
So it sounds like you were running a sitcom team, really, there. It was coming up with these little tiny vignettes like this.
Yeah, it was very much
focused
like that.
Effort.
It was very much like that.
And you've got to talk about how you broadened that and how you broadened the team, because were you at the beginning, you said that it was really an art working team, and it ended up obviously very creative, but did you start to take on board other aspects of agency like media buying and strategy, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so we had a couple of planners. Print production always remained in-house as it had been, you know, with the Mac operators, and that never really moved. Design and...
What about buying, though, and knowing which media to buy and all the logistics?
No, we never got involved in media buying.
So you did you always outsourced that?
Oh, yes. No, that was always outsourced, yes. Yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, really, you know, in retrospect, I think that the successful part of being in-house was really, you know, the bit that agencies, that clients tend to leave out. The successful part was the conceptual part, the creative part. And having that team embedded with the clients, and having that team having direct access to the marketing team, massively empowered myself and the creative team, and it gave us a position, you know, a really, I think, unrivaled position to input to the brand, to understand where the brand was going, and to help it to develop. You know, I think that really was the critical thing, and I think, you know, possibly, you know, more of the sort of process-driven stuff probably should have been outsourced, you know, because to be honest, really, you don't get any benefit having that close to the client, really, other than possibly, you know, a higher level of intervention.
Yeah, really interesting. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to talk about my day job, but certainly I'm part of companies, in-house agencies, who see that they want to keep the creative close and recognize that sometimes turning those ideas into assets is not core necessarily, and is a complicated process to run efficiently. And that's something we specialize in. But it's very interesting to hear how successful you've been, and not just in terms of you personally, Graham, and Specsavers, but the campaign's been successful and continues to be, and has done great things for Specsavers as a business, and enabled them to grow, expand, raise their awareness by having this model of keeping the creative close to the brand and the message itself.
Yeah, I think so, and I think, you know, my little story about the you know, the agency's customers, you know, is one aspect of that, and I think the other aspect, you know, when we did occasionally have we didn't use freelancers very often, and certainly not for very long, but when we did have freelancers, they're always amazed at the freedom that we had, you know, as an agency team to propose things and explore things, and you know, even to some degree to spend money, you know, kind of on projects that, you know, may or may not come to fruition. You know, we had a lot of freedom to just, you know, have a look and see if something worked and try something out and maybe make a prototype. And a lot of it was driven by the creatives. You know, it wasn't driven by, oh, the client wants this or the client wants that all the time. Although obviously, you know, a lot of what we did was. But the two things went hand in hand. You know, the two things went hand in hand. And I think that there was this culture. We built a culture that was a collaborative creative culture between the creative and the marketing teams, you know, and I think that worked. When it worked well, it worked very well.
It clearly did. There's no question about that. You left Specsavers early last year, I believe.
I did, in March, yeah.
In March, and you're now a hired gun if other corporations are looking to replicate the success of Specsavers as a consultant. Graham, it's been absolutely fascinating hearing your story. I really appreciate your time. If people, listeners, want to get hold of you,
I'm on LinkedIn, and I also have a website, which is grahamdaldry.com, which is fairly easy to remember. So there's a contact.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, I'm sure a lot of people will beat a path to that. Graham, once again, thank you so much for sharing your story on Inside Jobs.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Thanks to you, the listener, and to Graham Daldry, formerly of Specsavers, for taking the time out to be on the Inside Jobs podcast. This, for me, has been a fascinating insight into an amazing and very creative life. A big thanks to our fabulous partners at IHAF, specifically Emily Foster, my producer Amy McNamara, for making all these things possible, and to Prerna Chapra at EKCS for handling the editing work with such flair. If you've not heard this podcast before, then a very warm welcome to Inside Jobs. Do take a chance to visit us at our website at ijpodcast.com with its ever-growing back catalogue of episodes. And do also feel free to link in with me. I'm always up for a chat with anyone who works at in-house agencies, so do say hello. Thanks for joining us, and till the next time.